What does it mean to live a resilient life? I'm Ryan Mannion. I lost my brother to war and my mom to cancer, and I've learned a lot about myself along the way. Now, as the CEO of Travis Mannion Foundation, I'm on a journey to explore what it means to be resilient against life's many challenges. Join me and some incredible guests as we ask ourselves the hard questions and define what it means to struggle well.
All right. Well, welcome to another episode of the Resilient Life Podcast. I've been waiting for a long time to bring this guest on. Tulsi Gabbard, welcome to the Resilient Life.
Thank you, Ryan. I have been such an incredible fan of you and your work and how you continue to honor your brother by honoring so many people and creating this amazing community and family support system for each other. So I just want to sincerely thank you for all the work that you do and how you are finding your way to serve.
Thank you. And, you know, I feel so many synergies with you. Of course, I know so much about you, but I was doing my research and reading your bio because I was trying, I wasn't sure kind of how you got into elected office and what your path was that took you there. And, you know, you were 21 years old when you went and joined the state legislature, which is incredible. When you think about, I think of a lot of 21 year olds that I know right now, and that's not certainly something that's on their mind, but more importantly, your decision to become a congresswoman really stemmed from your time in Iraq and coming back. And you said, you know, you experienced firsthand the cost of war, and you ran at age 31, vowing to pay homage to the lives that were lost. And I'd love to talk a little bit more about that because my family kind of went through a very similar pathway, but I'd love to just learn why you felt it was so important. Obviously, you know, you go over to Iraq, you're losing your brothers and sisters in arms. But what was the decision that when I come back, I'm going to run for office and that's going to be where I make my mark and honor those lives lost?
Yeah, you know, it wasn't a very linear decision at all. You know, when I ran for state house in Hawaii, I was 21 years old. I didn't have a bachelor's degree at the time. I didn't have the things that people think, well, I've got to check all these boxes before I can run for any office. And I'm grateful. I have a lot of veterans who contact me, just some I know, most who are cold calling me and just asking for advice because they want to continue to serve in some way in public service after they lay down the uniform. But usually there's this concept of a prerequisite, whether it's to run for state house or assembly or for Congress or any other office, and it's just not true. I never thought at that time, like, okay, well, this is going to be my first step in a long political career, and I'll go here and then go there and then go there. It was really just driven out of a desire to serve my community and a recognition that we had politicians in Hawaii who were kind of seeing the job as more of like a kick your feet on the desk post-retirement gig than actually like getting their hands dirty, going out in the community, and really identifying what are the real problems that need to be solved rather than just waiting for people to knock on the door or call them and ask for help. And so I served for one term. I was campaigning for re-election. Our Hawaii Army National Guard Brigade Combat Team was activated for a deployment to Iraq. Long story short, I was not on the deployment roster. I was in a medical unit at the time, a headquarters medical unit. They had pulled someone else to fill the slot that I would have filled. And my commander called and said, hey, good news, you don't have to go. I just knew very quickly there was no way I was gonna stay home.
Yeah.
And so I withdrew from that reelection campaign, volunteered to deploy, got retrained in a job that they needed filling, and went, and during that year-long deployment to Iraq in 2005, as you mentioned, saw and experienced the reality and the harshness and the ugliness of war in all of its elements. And so coming back from that, a lot of my friends at home here in Hawaii, you know, they just assumed the natural thing would be to go back, run for my old seat again, kind of pick life up where I had left it. And I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. It didn't, I felt a sense of duty and responsibility to take those experiences that I had had, the things that I had learned, and try in some way, shape, or form to use them to positively impact the problems that I saw, to try to help work towards finding a solution. So it wasn't an immediate, like, okay, I'm going to come back and run for Congress. I really didn't know the answer to where and how I could best do that. And so I came back in 2006 from that deployment, ended up being having the opportunity to work as a legislative aide for one of Hawaii's US senators who was the chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee at the time. And so went to Washington for a couple of years and was able to take those experiences and apply them to support his work in a way that, what, he's a World War II veteran. The experience of Vietnam veterans, World War II veterans, Korean War veterans is very different from our experience as post 9/11 generation veterans. So long story short, my journey has been one of a constant state of self-reflection of how can I best be of service? How can I best make that most positive impact? And so while I came home from that first deployment in 2006, I didn't run for Congress until 2012. But all of those things, everything that happened over that period of time, including a second deployment to the Middle East, are what ultimately drove me both to run for Congress and to run for president, because of politicians who are out of touch, who don't really care, who are making these decisions that directly impact my brothers and sisters in uniform and wanting to do something to honor them.
Yeah, when my brother was killed in 2007, there was a couple things that happened that kind of showed me how heavily politics plays into things like war. And it was something that I was largely unaware of, during his time in service. My dad's a retired colonel in the Marine Corps, and I was a military kid. I bounced around from military base to military base when I was young. My mom was a classic military spouse, moved where we went, took care of the family. And for me, it was largely just this sense of patriotism and duty to country that I watched and witnessed my dad and my brother. But I'll never forget when my brother was killed. There was a civic building in our town, and I won't share what civic building it was, but they would change the number. And I noticed it before he left for Iraq. But every time a service member was killed, and this is at the height of the surge, and so, there's men and women dying every single day, and they would have a lives lost, and it was just a number that changed. And I'll never forget, it was a couple days after his funeral. I'm driving through town and I saw that the number had changed. And that number reflected my brother. And, I'm in the beginning stages of heavy grief, and I barged into the building, and I used some choice words to say that my brother is not just another number. I feel bad for the lady that I berated behind that desk, because I know that wasn't the decision that she made. But it was kind of that moment where I felt, oh my gosh, you have to step into the arena to make a difference. And these decisions that are being made for these young men and women are being made far off in a, in a boardroom that has nothing to do with these families that are suffering the loss. And, my dad ended up running for Congress in 2008, and he ran against Patrick Murphy, who was at the time the only Iraq War veteran in Congress. And so it was really a referendum on the Iraq War. Because you had this Gold Star father, retired Marine Corps colonel, and Patrick Murphy. And I've shared this story many times. So my dad ended up losing. He got more votes than any challenger in the state of Pennsylvania, but did not win. Obama won the election that year. He was a Republican. It wasn't, things were
Tough
not
year,
in his
tough
favor.
political year.
Tough political year. But because of that, I ended up running the following year for our township supervisor. And I wanted to play a decision. I wanted to make decisions, like you said, like how could I make decisions that helped the community and at large and starting from the ground up? And I ran, I got elected and I served 12 years. I actually just resigned after my second term in December. But that taught me so much about how important it is to get involved. And
Yes.
you know, for me, it was everything. And those last 12 years, and you know, which brings you to the fact, you know, you have a new book coming out, For Love of Country. And it's about people over party, right?
Yes.
And full circle, when I ran for re-election, it was again another tough year. I live in Bucks County. It is, if you are involved in presidential elections, you know Bucks County. We are a decision maker. And Bucks County is not Trump country. It's a 50-50 split, but it's not Trump Republicans here. And so when I ran for re-election, people just wanted to know if I voted for Trump. And I said, well, how about I tell
Wow.
you about what I did for the last 6 years?
Was it a nonpartisan race?
No.
Or did you have to pick a party? Okay.
Oh yeah, I had to pick a party. I ran as a
Okay.
Republican. Yeah. So
Okay.
I ran as a Republican and my opponent just tied me to Trump. You know, I had no affiliation with Trump, but I was a Republican, I was Trump. And
Yeah.
so I went back to Patrick Murphy. And Patrick Murphy is a well-known, you know, he was a congressman, he was undersecretary of the army, and he became a good friend after him and my dad ran. And I said to Patrick, you know, I've worked so hard these last 6 years, and I'm just getting trounced because I'm being tied to a president that plays no fact in what I've been doing here for 6 years. And he said, well, I'm going to come out and endorse you. And he did a mailer for me to all of the residents of Doylestown Township. He got blasted by the Democratic Party here in Bucks County. And I said, I feel really bad, Patrick, that you put your neck out for me. And he said those exact words to me. He said, Ryan, I'm people over party every day. I won that election by 6 votes. Six votes.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's such a great illustration of so many things, but right there, I hear unfortunately from people all the time who are just like, I'm so frustrated, I feel hopeless, my voice doesn't matter, my vote won't make a difference, the whole system is rigged. You go on and on and on. I'm sure you've heard this
Yeah.
over and over yourself. But that right there is such a great example of those six people ultimately deciding the election. And that's really what is at the core of my book, For Love of Country. It is a reminder to every one of us as Americans, regardless of your political affiliation. Obviously, in the book, I go through my journey of being a Democrat for over 20 years and the reasons, chapter by chapter, why I left the Democratic Party and became an independent. But it all comes down to this. If you are frustrated, if you are angry, if you are dissatisfied with the leadership that we have, that our founders were incredibly wise in their vision that they had, that they laid down in those founding documents, it's up to us to make a difference. There's no one single person, knight in shining armor who's going to come in and save us. We make the decisions about who we want to serve the people. Whether it be in your local township or board of education or a city council, mayor, congress, president, every position that we have this opportunity every year, every 2 years, whatever the cadence of the election is, to make that decision. And we can sit back and say, oh, well, I'm just going to vote down party line. But it's such a, it really is a disservice to those who have sacrificed so much to defend our freedom. To so easily throw away our own responsibility to do our part in defending our freedom right here at home, which is necessary. We say freedom isn't free. It's true. And there are so many different costs that go towards we as a free people having the right to exercise our freedom and the actions that we can take to defend it. And it's not just something that happens at the federal level, far away in Washington, DC. I think over the last, since COVID started, I think people are seeing more and more, oh my gosh, the local council, the local board of health, the local mayor, they can actually make these rules that are directly impacting your children, your family, your freedom here in Hawaii, your ability to go to the beach, go surfing, go swimming. I mean, I think things got very real, and that's why I wrote this book. I hope in this election year, people take some time to reflect for themselves, for ourselves, as you did when you decided to run, is how can I be a part? How can I be a part of the solution?
Yeah. And that's really, you know, I will tell you, I was in my 20s when I ran. I don't know. I was thinking of what can I do? And I don't know that I fully understood how much of an impact you can make at a local level.
Yes.
And the decisions that were being made here in my town of 20,000 that had far more impact on these residents than anything happening in DC.
Yes.
And, you know, I walk away from that with such a greater understanding of, again, that need to, you know, get involved. And yeah. I would say that every day to the people that would walk in and want to get behind the soapbox and just bark and bark and bark. And I'd say, we got a lot of committees on here. Why don't you come and join us? You know,
exactly.
So there's just so many opportunities. And, you know, one of the things I also was thinking, you know, when you ran for president, I was such a huge fan. Such a huge fan. And it was the first time, you know, I was born into a Republican household that, you know, that was what I was raised with. I became a Republican. I'm unabashful in saying that, but I am someone that I never voted party lines. I yeah. never will. And I never did. And my family taught me that as well. You know, it was like, well, we believe in conservative values, but we don't just push a button and vote down ticket. That's not what we do. We understand the people that we're voting for. Because guess what? There's really crappy Republicans too. And I've come across a lot of them. So,
yes.
And, but
just what you said, just what you said, it's people before party.
Right.
Period.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's the guiding principle, if that's the guiding light for people as we go and make these decisions, as we get educated, why primary elections are just as important as general elections, because we have that responsibility to choose not just the party, but actually which candidate is committed to the Constitution and committed to putting the interests of the people ahead of party or self or anything else.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I've noticed that as a society, we've gotten so far away from that. Like, I don't think we could be further away from that. And, you know, I think a lot about how we overcome the polarization that is just taking over our country right now. And I went back because I was curious and I didn't know the answer to this, how many of our presidents were not veterans. And, you know, out of the 46, there were only 14 presidents that have not served their country. And
wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so 31 have served the military in one way or another. The last president that we had that served in the military was George Bush. The most decorated president was his father, actually, military decorated. But I started to think about, because I think about the work that we do at the Travis Manion Foundation, and it's all about making sure that we are putting veterans front and center for our next generation. We are getting them out into communities. And I thought, I almost believe that it should be a prerequisite because of where we are today with everything happening with national security and our national defense. I feel that it should be a prerequisite that you have to serve, along with being 35 and a US citizen, you should have to serve in the military to run for president. And I believe that could be a difference maker for how we move forward as a society. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I disagree with the prerequisite requirement solely because when you look at the prerequisites that are laid out in the Constitution is, you know, you're born a US citizen and you're 35 years old. That's it. That's the prerequisite. And the reason why, and I want to get into this a little bit, but when we look at the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, for example, it lays out the very, very limited role that government should play to ensure our liberty as citizens in this country, to be able to decide things for ourselves to the utmost extent possible.
Yeah.
So we have these limited guardrails that are put forth in our founding documents. I think that it's incredibly valuable and important for voters to look at, well, what experience do you bring to the table? You're asking for my trust and my vote to give you that honor and responsibility of serving as president and commander in chief. The onus is put on us to be able to decipher those characteristics that we want. I agree. I think that having that experience, I can speak firsthand, it has exposed me to and taught me so much in a deeply visceral and personal way that has informed my foreign policy and the kind of work that I've done on different policies, whether it's in office or even out of office. My advocacy for leaders who are who must be more thoughtful and careful before deciding to go and start a war or topple a dictator or send our troops to one place or another place without clearly thinking through some basic things like what are we trying to accomplish? Does it serve the best interests of the United States and the American people? Will this be counterproductive and actually undermine our national security? What does winning look like? How do you define this? When do you know when it's time to exit? Do you have a plan for that? All of these things are basic concepts, and yet so many of our political leaders, they don't ask themselves this question, nor are they able to answer them when asked. I'm thinking through some diplomatic ways to say this. I have worked with other people in politics who have worn the uniform, and I'm grateful to them, as I am to all veterans who volunteer to serve. However, they have, in some cases, lacked this kind of care and thoughtfulness in how they approached and advanced their own foreign policy. Some who just say, oh, we should just go bomb the shit out of the bad guys. I get that kind of talk maybe as you're sitting in the team room, but if you're in a position of great power where you are directly making decisions about what the repercussions of that kind of action would be, you've got a lot more responsibility to really think through what does that mean? And so this exchange I had with another member of Congress who was a veteran happened on live TV. And I think my response to him was like, well, tell me exactly who are the bad guys? How are they going to respond? And it was just it was a little example that showed me just like, wow, okay, this guy has also served our country in uniform, and yet he appears to have the lack of depth in understanding the process we need as American service members, veterans, military families, the process we need our leaders to go through before making that decision. We all volunteer to serve, knowing that at some point we may be called to put our lives on the line. Our leaders, and that's a free choice made out of free will. Our leaders' responsibility is to make sure that that decision is made with great care, understanding the massive, immeasurable cost that those individuals and their families are making, and that it is only as a last resort to serve the safety, security, and freedom interests of the American people and our country. So all of that is to say, just like we need politicians to put country before party, whether one has served or one hasn't served, we as voters have to do our job to hold them accountable, to their approach and to the decisions that they're making.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. And, I think I find myself now in a position where, again, I was very jaded at our government after my brother was killed, because I remember the conversations that I had with my brother, that my dad had with my brother. And, my dad or my brother would constantly say things like, people have no idea what's happening over here. They just, and I'm sure you saw it too. And he was part of a MIT team. He was training the Iraqi army, and he felt such a kinship with the Iraqis that he was training. I mean, so much so that we've had some of them here at our house and have broke bread with them here in Pennsylvania because they ended up getting visas and coming over here. The Iraqis held a memorial service for Travis after he was killed. And I remember his commanding officer said, in all my time here, I've never seen the Iraqis hold a memorial service for an American service member. And so, I think about it from that perspective, right? But then I also think about it from the perspective, I've got a daughter that's going to the Naval Academy next year. Wow. So on June 27th, she's going to raise her right hand. And all of a sudden now I'm a military mom. And I'm so proud of her. And I'm so excited for her path forward. But it scares me. I'm not going to lie. It scares me to think about decisions that can be made by career politicians that make some of those decisions, like you say, without enough depth and thought. And, you know, I try to think about what can we do outside of, you know, we talk about getting involved, moving the needle, stepping into the arena, but like, what can we do? Like, what can the everyday American do to help stop some of the polarization that's happening in our country right now? Like, what advice could you give to the person listening that says, like, what role can I play? I'm not going to run for office. That's not something I can do, but what can I do right now?
I think a lot of people, and this is the question. Yeah. This is the question, really. A lot of people underestimate their sphere of influence. You think like, oh, maybe I'm just a mom, or I'm just a teacher, I'm just a this, just a that. And I hate it when people say that, because they really do underestimate their power and their influence to be the change, to be a part of the solution, to step into the arena, as you say. The way the arena is defined is different for every one of us, because we're unique as people. Our experience is unique, our background is unique. But let's say you're a mom raising your kids at home. Look at your phone, scroll down your phone and see all of the names that are in your phone. Those are people that you know personally to one degree or another, and you have an ability to impact. You think about, you know, maybe the other moms in the neighborhood who you see at the park every day with your kids, or, you know, maybe it's a parent teacher association, whatever that is, you have an ability to impact and influence those people. And it really just starts with what we in Hawaii call aloha, which means respect. It means love. It means compassion. It's a recognition that, and it's the reason why we use it to greet people. When we greet people with aloha, it's a recognition that we are all children of God. We are, you know, that eternal spirit that is inside of every one of us. And so we can see past, oh, you're a Democrat, you're a Republican, you know, you're a Trump supporter, you're a Biden supporter. You know, you're black, you're white, you're Hispanic, like your religion, Christian, Hindu, Muslim, all of these different labels that are unfortunately so often used in this polarized time to tear us apart and put us in these little boxes. Every single one of us has the ability and the opportunity to start to change that, to instead of easily casting someone with a broad brush judgment because of they are this, fill in the blank. Instead, maybe reach out and have a conversation that you wouldn't have had before and just say, hey, how's it going? How are you? What are you up to? What is, you know, what's on your mind? What do you care about? And that really is how we begin to, come together, because ultimately, whatever your political differences may be, or your other things that tend to segment us into these different categories in society, at our core, we are Americans.
Right.
We live in this country that remains the greatest country in the world, even with our flaws and challenges. And our freedom is really what makes this country so great. Our freedom is what is under attack right now. And so when people, you know, I often remind people as I'm going around and speaking at different events and talking with different groups of people, it's okay to disagree with someone.
Yeah.
It's okay to be friends with someone who you disagree with. When you look back to our founding fathers, they had fierce disagreements about a lot of different things, but they came together around these fundamental principles of freedom that are enshrined in our Constitution, our God-given and inalienable rights. And that those are the things that we have to be able to come together around so that we can have this open marketplace of ideas, so we can have the freedom to worship as we choose or not at all, so that we can have the ability to choose for you as a mom, as parents, how to raise your kids, what kind of education you want to give them, what kind of opportunity you are seeking to present for for them and their future. All of these things come down to us as Americans being able to come together around those fundamental principles and treating each other with respect.
And I largely think that the vast majority of Americans fully believe that. Mm-hmm. And they fall into this group, you know, when you think about it, I look at it this way. I think about my kids, and I've got three kids. My kids don't pick their friends based off their political affiliations,
right,
their religious backgrounds, or their socioeconomic makeup. My kids pick their friends because they find people that they can have fun with and do things. Yes. They have, you know, and they find common ground in being happy with each other. And I also, you know, of course, when we're adults and we start to have all of these other noises in our head, I look at our military service members. And if you look at our military, it's perhaps the greatest social experiment of diversity and diverse backgrounds coming together for a common goal, right? And yes. And I feel like if we could get behind, and again, the military does not come without its flaws as well as every group has, but if you look at the social experiment that is our military, where everybody is free to join, but you must all understand the principles for which you stand for, right? And we stand for as an organization, and you're never going to fully agree with every decision, but at the end of the day, you're all going to disagree and commit, I guess is the best way to say it, yeah. Right? And come together. And so I think about, you know, and that's one of the things that we largely focus on, like when our service members take off the uniform, all of those things are intangible skill sets that they have learned that our civilian counterparts haven't. And we need to make sure that they are not taking all of that and it just lies with them. And so that's why for us, we are always saying, like, you've taken off the uniform, but we need to put you in a different uniform. And yeah. This uniform is how you serve your communities, you know?
Exactly. And that may be through a nonprofit. It may be through a business. It may be through education. It may be through tech. There's I think all the misconceptions and like preconceptions of what people think service is often, you know, you are either a firefighter or you serve in the military or you're a first responder. But really what it means to serve is to dedicate your skills and your talents and your experience in service to others, to make that positive impact. And I've seen how I think someone was telling me about how in Israel, military service is seen as like the industry, you know, different industries and different sectors. They've headhunters, they're always trying to recruit the best and top talent. They really place that military leadership experience at the top of that list because they understand how it's so easily transferable and applicable to every other part of our society. And I love and appreciate what you're doing, because to me, that's the shift that we need to see take place here in our own country, is instead of seeing veterans as victims or somehow people who are, handicapped, I suppose, in right. some fashion and deserving of therefore some charity, but looked at with like, oh, kind of a poor you. Yes, we thank you for your service, but poor you. That this experience that you're talking about, these intangibles, these qualities and characteristics that so many of our veterans have because of that decision that they made to serve, make them the greatest asset to all of these different kinds of organization. And my hope is that we have business leaders, community leaders, neighbors, friends, residents, schools, who really start to recognize that as more and more of our generation of veterans are stepping out of uniform and trying to figure out, how do I find this purpose that right. is rooted in service in this next phase of life?
And I think, you know, we have found, we base a lot of the work we do off a Pew study that came out a few years ago that said, you know, 55% of veterans that take off the uniform cite that they feel disconnected.
Yeah.
The communities in which they return to. And so for us, it was this kind of simple science of, Okay, well, let's make sure they don't feel disconnected. And how do you not feel disconnected? Well, you give community back to them. And so, you know, the Travis Manning Foundation does a lot of things, but at the end of the day, we say we are a large community. We're a community where you can come to find that continued purpose. And I think, you know, there's this middle ground that we have to come. I think we've come a long way. I remember being at a conference several years ago and speaking about why it's so important to recruit military talent into the civilian sector. And one of the CEOs raised his hand and said something like, well, I just don't want to deal with veterans and like the PTSD thing. And, you know, there was a lot of eye rolling, and we had to explain some that the vast majority of veterans are sitting in a place where they're thriving and ready to go. But you also don't want to forget that there is a epidemic happening right now with our veteran population that is extreme with, you know, suicidal ideation. And, you know, as we make sure we're highlighting that veterans are civic assets, I don't want to forget the fact that we have to make sure that we are being proactive. And I don't think anybody, I think there's a lot of solution-based approaches for veterans when they were in that crisis, and they are at that final stage. But nobody is focusing on how to prevent them from getting there. And, you know, we talk a lot about the VA really starting to adopt these holistic approaches because you see it. You're at events with veterans a lot. You see what bringing veterans together and bringing that community together, that's really, at a lot of times, that's all it takes. I see it every day. But it's like they can't conceptualize that just bringing people together with a common purpose is going to help. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating for us to see that we can't adopt just simple ideas to show how we can kind of stop veterans from getting to that place of isolation.
What you're talking about is right. If as a society and the VA, those who are in a position to best help people are seeing that their task is to say, well, hey, here's a number you can call 24/7 to reach out if you reach or when you reach that point,
Right.
which is really the last, it's that moment to moment between are you going to actually act on that suicidal ideation? Or will there be someone there to help talk you off the proverbial ledge? If that's the approach, and it so often is, and I've seen people at high levels within the VA patting themselves on the back for just having a 24/7 helpline, when really, as you've just perfectly pointed out, that's the last resort measure.
Right.
Really, they should be thinking outside the box and working with organizations like yours to be able to help create that sense of community, support that sense of community even before people get out, help create those opportunities and those avenues that provide that sense of purpose. Because I know for people I've known personally and others who I've heard about, often, as you said, it's feeling like you're alone. You've lost that sense of community. And you go from working on an environment where literally every day of your life, in some way, shape, or form, is purpose driven.
Right.
You are getting up and you're doing, turning the wrenches on the Humvee, or you're getting up and going and running around in the jungle out here in Schofield Barracks, miserable, dirty, hungry, but you're with your buddies, and you know that all of you together are working towards this same higher purpose of service. Service to our country and our fellow Americans. It's probably not something you think about every day, but deep down inside, this is why you join. This is why you do this every day for a living, because you could do a lot of other things that may not require that sacrifice. And so preemptively recognizing that, and these things get lip service. I mean, these are not novel ideas we're talking about, but the gap in the delta between understanding truly how to help people continue to be motivated with that sense of purpose, and actually executing is the gap that organizations like yours are filling. And without getting too down into the deep hole of like big government bureaucracy and all that's wrong with it, but really it is that rigidity of the bureaucracy and an organization that ultimately through their actions we see that they are prioritizing feeding the bureaucracy over actually, you know, flexing and molding and being able to look and come up with really creative ideas on how to best serve veterans. And so, you know, okay, good, easy for me to say, but this is where, again, there are through lines here connected to it matters who we vote for office. It matters the kind of people that they select, for example, to run the VA. It matters who you vote for Congress, because there's a lot of resistance to cutting that red tape within the VA, as an example, but across federal agencies, by people who are more interested in protecting union rules than they are about making sure that we have public servants in these positions who care more for their customer, their end user, their client, the American people, than they do about this kind of inward-looking self-protection. Well, I gotta save this job and that job and that job, and not as like, are they actually doing a good job? Are they actually providing a quality service to people, whether it be veterans or, you know, someone walking into the DMV? The lack of actual matching how our taxpayers' dollars are being spent, the quality of the service that's being provided, and the metrics of success. These are the kinds of things that we should demand our leaders to change and to address.
I think so. And I think, you know, for us, we always say that it's important that we include more veteran voices in these
Yes.
conversations. And not just from the, you know, not just as elected officials, but just in the conversation.
Yeah.
Right. And so, giving them this platform, you know, one of our flagship programs at Travis Manion Foundation is called Character Does Matter. So we actually train veterans to go out and deliver character education to our youth. And
Wow.
so for them, the, you know, for us, the program was created to give veterans purpose, to bring them back to that community, to put them into the community and show that they are civic assets. But the offset is we've had 500,000 kids who have gone through a program being taught what it means to live a life of service by veterans. So,
Right.
you know, we're having secondary success with that in itself. And, you know, we can see no better way for veterans to thrive than by coming home and sharing their stories and not saying, I'm trying to indoctrinate you to join the military, but more so to say, hey, I served my country in this way. But you
Yes.
can all be servant leaders in your own backyards, like you said, in a plethora of different ways. But
Yes.
kids understanding that as a young age, at a young age is so vital and important. And it's something that's largely been stripped away from our education system, in the recent years, you know?
Yeah, and we're seeing the ramifications of that in very far-reaching ways, and that's where when we see the headlines, we hear from leaders in the Pentagon saying, gosh, you know, we can't figure out why no one wants to join the military these days. There's just a bunch of fat kids and they don't care. And yet they just, it seems like they're just throwing up their hands and not actually having the kinds of conversations that we're having and recognizing the problems that you found is that why would a young person who has not been exposed to someone who has made that decision to serve the military before? Less than 1% of the population serves in the military, so that number of people who don't have that connection is continuing to grow. If they're not being taught basic civics or about the Constitution, about the full history of our country and what we stand for, the pillars of what it means to be an American, maybe they're not even saying the Pledge of Allegiance anymore in school. Why would they be drawn to this call to serve? If why would they be drawn to serve in a military where they may have to risk their life if they don't really even know what they are sacrificing for, or what what makes this country as unique and great as it is.
Yeah, and we recognized in the last few years the and we've had conversations in DC about the recruitment crisis and what and really if you look at, like you said, at our past history, people joined the military because they had models in front of them, be it their parents or their siblings. Like my brother was a Marine because my dad was a Marine, and my dad was a Marine because my grandfather served in World War II with the Army Air Corps. Like that's, and so as that goes further and further away, like we have to put relevant and relatable models in front of kids. And it's not an indoctrination, but they need to understand. They need to see this person from my community left high school and maybe went right into the Army or the Marine Corps, or they went to college and then went to into a service branch. But they need to see these examples and hear these stories, because if they're not hearing these stories, it doesn't make sense to them. It's not even an option that's put on the table for them. And
That's
so,
right.
it's a I'll say it's a third effect of the work that we're doing at the Travis Manion Foundation, but something that we recognize is very important. And I think, again, I think having people, and especially for you, being a veteran, but being a female veteran. And so we do a lot of recruitment within our program to find female veterans, because I love the idea. And I always say, my daughter was driven to go to the Naval Academy, not because of her uncle, who was a combat Marine, but because of other young women that I've had the opportunity to get to know. And she saw them herself in their shoes.
Wow.
And she would watch these young girls and say, "Oh, wow, wait, mom, they're a Marine." I'm like, "Yeah, she's a Marine." And she was like, "Oh, wow." And so I started getting her on Zoom calls with young girls that had attended the academy, and all of a sudden it started to click for her. And she's like, "Wait, I could see myself doing this." And so you need to make sure that we're putting these people in front of our next generation. It's just so vitally important.
In this very influence heavy environment that we
Yeah.
live in.
Well, and it's so funny, Tulsi, because there's a couple young women, and they're awesome. They're in their early 20s, and they have large social media platforms. One of them's in the Navy, one of them's a Marine, and they're TikTok and Instagram influencers. I mean, they are. And not endorsed by the DOD, that says that clearly in their bio, but they show themselves in uniform one day, and the next day they show themselves in a cute dress out, like having fun. And I love what they're putting out there, because I think it takes away kind of the stigma of, for young women at least, it takes away the stigma of, that the military, the rigidness, and that you can't live a life outside of that and be fulfilled outside of that and continue to have the same passions and hobbies that you do, And so I'm always like, if I see one of these young women, I'll like share it with my daughter. I'll be like, "Oh, check out this girl," So,
What does your daughter want to do? Does she want to be a Marine?
she does want to be a Marine. Yes.
Okay.
So she wants to, but she's thinking like public affairs officer,
Okay.
and I am, as a mother, I say, I love that idea.
Yeah, I like that
Great
idea.
public affairs officer. But she's got 4 years ahead of her, and they're going to introduce her to every single opportunity within the Navy and Marine Corps. And so who knows what path she takes. Right now, she comes from a pretty heavy Marine Corps family, so we'll see. But maybe she ends up in the fleet, who knows, as a SWO. All right, a couple quick questions before we go. If you could recommend any book for our audience to read, one book that has influenced you.
It's hard to pick just one. I'll tell you the one that I have been that's a little bit off maybe the beaten path, but I know
Love that.
you are friends with and supported by our mutual friend Jocko Willink. And the book is called Musashi, and it's a long book. It is fiction, but it is based on some very fundamental I would say it's kind of the Japanese samurai version of stoicism in a way.
Okay.
But it tells the story of this young boy who faces great adversity and is confronted with battle and massacre and lost in his community from a very young age, and goes throughout his life pursuing the warrior path. And has to constantly make decisions about whether or not he's willing to sacrifice his own selfish desires to serve the well-being of his community. This answer to call to serve in his life was the path of the warrior. It's a long book. I listen to it on audiobook. I do it while I'm working out or cooking or stuck on airplanes or whatever. But it's a really powerful book that has a lot of very applicable lessons as we look in our own lives about the necessity of discipline. It's all the things we've been talking about, living a disciplined life
Yeah.
with intention, how you react to some of the most horrific things that may be occurring to you or around you, and really how the choices that you make. You are in control of one thing, and that is your free will and the decisions that you make and how you react to these different situations. And I love it. It's not one that is often in the top 10 or 20 or 50 list of leadership
I
books,
like
but
this. A lot of times I get kind of the,
yeah,
by
you
Angela
expect
Duckworth, like
right.
Extreme Ownership by Jocko and Leif. It's, I love
Great
this.
books. They're
Yes,
great
they
books,
are great
but
books.
this one just, and I thought of this because we're talking about influence
Yeah.
and we're talking about both the positive and negative influences in our society today. And, one of the most powerful ways to convey a message or to teach a lesson is through the telling of stories. And this book does a phenomenal job, and it's applicable to men and women and people of all ages.
I love it. I'm going to read it. And okay, so about your new book,
Yes,
regardless
I was
of,
just thinking like, oh, my publisher's probably going to watch and be like, why didn't you say your book?
well,
No,
so we're going to talk about your new book,
I know.
regardless of political affiliation, what is something that we can all learn or take away from your new book?
Thank you, first of all. This book really is something that I hope conveys to people. The importance of understanding who we are as individuals, as people, in a spiritual sense, and as Americans, and understanding what is at stake, what we cherish or proclaim to cherish and value in this country, and how those fundamental, God-given rights and freedoms are under assault. This is not a time to throw up our hands or put our head in the sand and think, oh gosh, we are beyond redemption. There are changes that are being made that are irreparable. And let me just go and focus on my little piece of earth, my family, my home, my job, my kids' education, and I'm going to tune everything else out.
Yeah.
We cannot afford to do that because inaction will result in us losing this country that we love, all of us as Americans. And so there's a clear call to action that I open and close the book with that really I hope serves as a reminder to the individual challenge, opportunity, and responsibility that we have as Americans to take action to save our country and to defend our freedom.
I love that so much. I'm so excited to read it. And my last question that I will ask you, I ask everybody, what does living a resilient life look like for you?
In order to live a resilient life, it's important for us to, I think about the importance of spiritual, physical, and mental well-being. That life is short, as you know, probably more than many. Our time can come at any moment. And every day that we wake up with breath in our bodies is a blessing. And living a resilient life requires us to remember that blessing, to practice gratitude. And no matter what kind of adversity you may face, resilience is remaining spiritually grounded and focused on how you can turn that adversity into something positive, whether it be for yourself or your family, or from the greater sense of the word to those around you. It's our choice.
I love that you brought the spiritual component into it. I don't think in our 80 plus guests that we've had, nobody's brought the spiritual component into what living a resilient life lives. So I love that. Tulsi, your new book, For Love
Thank
of
you.
Country.
I'm gonna hold it up here. For Love
Yes.
of Country, it's available now on Amazon and on tulsigabbard.com. You can order a signed copy with a discount. But appreciate you so much, Ryan. Thank you for having me here to be able to talk to you, not just about the book, but about the work that you're doing and how we all have a part to play in this service to our men and women in uniform, our brothers and sisters, our families, and our country.
Tulsi, thank you. Thank you for your service in uniform and your continued service out of it. For Love of Country, you can order it. We'll have the link on our YouTube channel and you can get it on Amazon and tulsigabbard.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great to see you.